From 90.5 WESA, this is the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The logistics and implementation of remote learning has posed some additional challenges, including for thousands of special needs students in our region.
And I think it is important for a lot of them to be there. A lot of our students need some hands-on activities and things that are very difficult for them over Zoom or virtually.
Coming up, a conversation with three area special needs educators. All of the restrictions and health concerns have students and their parents under stress, and definitely teachers as well.
And like you would do on an airplane, in order to help people, you got to put the oxygen on yourself. You have to take care of yourself so that we can take care of our students and our families.
The mental well-being of instructors as they adapt to a new environment. The Confluence starts now. Tens of thousands of students throughout the Pittsburgh area have begun the school year learning remotely, online. The technology might prove to be a challenge, maybe more so for parents, but what about for special needs students who benefit from that in-person relationship and instruction? We're going to talk about how these students do not get left behind. Brian Wells is Assistant Director of Special Education and Pupil Services for the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. Brian, welcome.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having us.
Michaela Nolfi is a secondary learning support teacher at Sunrise, one of three special ed schools for the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. Michaela, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Maria Bennis is a hearing support teacher at AIU who works in a couple of different school districts in the county. Welcome to the Confluence, Maria.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be here.
According to education officials, there are 21,000 students in Allegheny County with disabilities, learning disabilities, health impairments, speech and language impairments, autism, emotional disturbance, and intellectual disabilities. With such a wide range of disabilities, how do we avoid a one-size-fits-all, a one plan for all students with disabilities during the pandemic restrictions? Brian, let's start with you.
You know, one of the cornerstones of special education services is the individualized nature of how we support students. Those students' individualized education plans, their IEP teams, which involve their parents, their school supports and services, their teachers, administrators, their buildings, and those community supports. I think starting out, it's just a lot of conversation.
Michaela?
I actually have students in the classroom, virtual, so on Zoom most of the day or doing asynchronous work, and then I also have students doing paper pencil. So it just depended on what the IEP team decided and what we thought was best for that student, and then providing them with these opportunities still with their peers. So the kids that are on Zoom are on most of the day and they're joining in on class doing the same activities that their peers are doing. And we're creating activities that fit the needs of students on Zoom and students in person.
Maria, are you meeting at all with any of your students in person, or is it all remote?
I am. I do both. I have some students who are fully remote right now, and then I have some students who may be participating in a hybrid type of model at their school.
Each school district drew up its own plan for the new school year, start online, maybe a hybrid, some days in the classroom, some days at home. But are there students with certain disabilities that it's an absolute must for in-person instruction? Michaela?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, like we said earlier, the IEP team decides what's best for the student, and that's the teacher, the administrators, the parents, the student, if they're at the age that they can. And I think it is important for a lot of them to be there. I think a lot of our students need some hands-on activities and things that are very difficult for them over Zoom or virtually. And we're still able to make those hands-on activities safe. You know, I know a lot of teachers in our building are doing hands-on activities and making sure that students either have separate materials or sanitizing materials between uses. So I think that is very important for many of our students because they need that direct atmosphere where they can be there in the classroom learning.
Maria and Michaela, with remote learning, parents are finding themselves as teachers, or at least as teachers' aides for special needs students. Is parental help sufficient?
Now, coming back in the fall, I found that the students I've been working with, and I've been one-on-one with my students, have been what we would say is asynchronously. So we're actually meeting in real time and we're face to face. And I'm finding that parent involvement is not needed quite so much for my particular demographic of students. When they're at home, I can often walk them through things that would allow them to have a little more independence, you know, and not have to rely on their parents.
Well, Maria, follow up. You're a hearing support teacher. How does that work remotely?
Ideally, we'd like to be in person, you know, but access is absolutely one of the biggest challenges that we face as teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing. We always have to be thinking about how are our students who are deaf and hard of hearing accessing learning and communication. So you may consider the challenge of being remote. A student may need access to a sign language interpreter. Some of my students have reported, as well as their families and that communication, that there's distortion or muffling of instructional videos. For our students, a big support that we provide is helping and supporting in their hearing assistive technology. So a lot of those students are able to plug directly into their learning device, whether it be a Chromebook, an iPad, etc., and then teaching our kids to really be on top of like enabling their closed captions in a meeting, as well as working with the classroom teachers and other professionals who may be working with our students in how to produce and create captioned media.
Mm-hmm. Michaela, for the students that you work with, what is the role of the parents? I mean, they're not trained in special ed. Can this ensure that their children are getting the education they need while they're also dealing with the demands of their own jobs if they are part of the teaching process?
Like Maria said, I think we've shifted more to synchronous learning where the kids are on. So in our school, mainly the parents are just trying to get their students on to Zoom or the class website. And we've done a lot with Google Sites. So we try to keep everything in one place. So that makes it a little bit easier for parents so that they don't have to keep track of all of these links. They have one link and then they know where to go to find their teacher's page. The parents are doing a great job with keeping their kids engaged and keeping them on. And I think it's also important that we offer them support as well as the students. So I've been emailing parents more than ever just to keep them in the loop and keep them updated on what's going on.
It's a special edition of the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with Brian Wells, Assistant Director of Special Education and Pupil Services for the Allegheny Intermediate Unit, Michaela Nolfi, a secondary learning support teacher, and Maria Bennis, a hearing support teacher. Because schools shut down early, we heard some educators say they were concerned that the usual summer slide, that learning loss that occurs during summer vacation, would be exacerbated when the new school year started. Has anybody noticed that being an issue for the students? Brian, we'll start with you.
You know, that was a big concern for us coming through this summer. One of the things that we do have the benefit and we were able to do with our programs, and we did offer what's known as an extended school year program or ESY program for our students this summer. We did it 100% online. It was all virtual. But the design of extended school year is really to be a opportunity to work with students in the summer during that extended break to try to limit and reduce the impact of that summer slide. One of the things that all school districts and special education programs have to do in Pennsylvania is look at those specific data. So the first few weeks of school, we have to do basically assessment, monitoring of the students' goals and their progress and where they are now compared to where they were in the spring prior to March when the schools closed down, and do an assessment of how much regression has occurred during that time period. Then the districts and the instructional programs and the students, along with their IEP team and their families, kind of make a determination of how that regression, and then come up with a plan to try to get the student back to where they were. If there was a significant amount of regression, then get them back to where they were within the first couple months of school. And if additional services are needed to kind of close that gap due to the closure, then there is a process in place to try to provide those additional services. So although I haven't seen the data yet because we're still just kind of finishing the collection.
Well, briefly, Michaela, and then Maria, have you noticed any regression anecdotally?
There has been some, but I think too, like anyone else, if you don't use it, you lose it. So I think it's so important for us to get back in and be able to start that instruction again so that they gain those skills back.
Mm-hmm. Maria?
I'm finding that my students, you know, once they jump right back into the instruction with me, you know, things come right back to them and, you know, they're picking up those skills again.
So are you two prepared to deal with that regression, Maria?
I feel that I am, yes. And like Brian said, we are still in that process of we're still collecting the data. But as we continue to analyze the data that we collect, we'll obviously and of course let that drive our instruction going forward.
To each of you, what is needed from the state or the school districts that some of you work with so that the special needs students are where they need to be, should be academically at the end of this school year? Maria, let's start with you this time.
At least for me to do the job that I do, supporting the demographic of students that I work with, I think we're going to need to continue to assess like what the needs are in terms of like protective equipment for our students, because that has been a very individualized decision that I've been working with not only the parents but really closely with my students to determine what do you need. What is your preference? Maybe that's, you know, what is the hearing assistive technology that you use? How is it working for you remotely as well as in person right now when, you know, your teachers as well as your peers are all needing to wear a mask? You yourself as a student who is deaf or hard of hearing have to wear a mask. And how does that work when you have to wear hearing aids or a cochlear implant? And so I think maybe just like, you know, funding needs to continue from the state so that we have the ability to purchase the things that those students need in terms of equipment in order to remain safe, but also to be able to have access to all the communication that's happening around them on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Michaela, are you confident at the end of this school year that your students will be where they need to be academically?
Yeah, I think so. I think pushing forward and giving them the academics that they need, and then I think also staying positive about the whole situation. You know, our students aren't being punished if they're not wearing a mask, but we're constantly offering that positive reinforcement. But I think just staying positive in the situation and reminding them that everything will be okay and showing them a good example. And I think now, especially for us having most of our students back in the building or on Zoom or getting paper pencil, I think providing them with this instruction and continuing to get creative using the different technology like our Promethean boards or different sites like IXL or Boom cards, I think is key to getting them back where they need to be.
Brian, you get the final word. What is needed so that the kids succeed?
I think you know, one of the things we talk about with our special education teachers, you know, and this is some of the things that they do all the time, whether it's in a pandemic or not, but they look at a situation, they come up with a plan to adapt, to accommodate, to support students who have some different learning needs. I mean, this is what they do all the time. For us, the big focus was making sure they had the professional development, making sure they had the skills that they needed to meet the needs of those students. And you know, a lot of it comes down to making sure we have the appropriate funding to develop those programs, support those staff, support not just our IU staff, but our district staff. This is what special educators do. They adapt, they overcome, they work with students who have different learning needs, and they make sure by the end of the year that they meet those targets, they meet those goals. You know, this is pandemic or otherwise, this is what they do.
And the kids seem to be adaptable, resilient, maybe more so than all the administrators and teachers.
You know, I definitely think that is true. One of the things we did at the end of the first week, we met with our principals and of our three buildings, and we said, you know, how was the first week? We spent all summer planning for this, and I think the best compliment was the principal said, you know what, this first week of school looked a little bit different, but it felt the same as every other first week of school.
Brian Wells is Assistant Director of Special Education and Pupil Services for the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. Michaela Nolfi is a Secondary Learning Support Teacher at Sunrise, one of the three special ed schools by the AIU. And Maria Bennis is a Hearing Support Teacher working in a couple of different school districts. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mary Lee Williams. Mental health and virtual learning. When people hear this, their brains may immediately go to the student's mental health and how that impacts their ability to learn in a virtual environment. But just as critical to learning is the instructor's mental well-being. Educators across the country have had to quickly adapt to a whole new teaching environment, while still, in some cases, being expected to meet testing benchmarks and virtually monitor students. This could have some teachers burned out, stressed, and unable to teach effectively. Doreen Allen is a learning environment specialist with Pittsburgh Public Schools. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Doreen, you work with parents, families, teachers, school district officials every day. You're entrenched in this world. What kind of impact does teacher mental health have on instruction?
Teachers have a lot of struggles right now, okay? We're going into something that's uncharted. And I think our teachers are feeling the pressure of being blamed right now for things that are beyond their control. Teachers do not make the decision to come back to school or not to come back to school. You know, and I think they're struggling with that guilt, along with a number of other things that we're facing right now. My job really is to build a positive school culture and help make teachers, staff, students, families, everyone feel welcome when they come into the school building. This is like a Pandora's box right now that's being opened. And the mental health of teachers is very hard to put your finger on the pulse and how to help. And I think about that every day because I come in and I said, how can I help? Like, how can I help the teachers as a whole? And here's what I'm finding out, is that it's an individualized way to help. Not one teacher or not a group of teachers need the same thing. It's like teaching. You know, our students need individualized instruction, and our teachers right now need individualized help. So I ask a teacher on a daily basis, how can I help? And each time I get a different answer.
That sounds like it would be a lot of things to take on then, particularly depending on what kind of resources that you might have at your disposal.
Right. You know, we're limited on resources right now because we're still trying to figure it all out. Like, how do we navigate the space that we're in? So how do we practice emotional first aid for ourselves and for teachers when we don't know exactly where to start? So, like, for instance, I'm on my way into work today and I get a call from a teacher and I said, how can I help? One of the things they mentioned is we just need more transparency. We wake up every day and we don't know what to expect. So I don't have an answer for that because I'm not the individual that makes those calls.
So when it comes to supporting teachers in learning environments right now, what are some things you think, you know, in an ideal world, what are some supports that you think teachers could use right now?
You know what? They really need time. One of the teachers I talked to today, just on the way in, they're teaching literally for like almost 7 hours a day online. I mean, that's a lot of time online to just be there focused on that. And no real human interaction as far as like you're seeing a screen with maybe 9, 10, 18, however many kids' faces you can get on the screen, but there's no real personal interaction. So teachers, I think, just need some time away. I think we also need to start helping more with the rituals and routines to help teachers focus their classes in this virtual environment, because how do you know kids are really getting what you're asking them to get? And then I think teachers need some type of empathy and just gratitude, some thank yous. It doesn't hurt to say thank you to a teacher. They're doing everything they possibly can to make things work in this uncertain environment, and they just need a bit of gratitude, some consistency, just saying thank you, appreciation, I think. But they do need time. They need time to master some of the things that they're asked to teach.
If you could broadcast one message right now out to teachers across the Pittsburgh area, you know, one thing to maybe just a reminder, just, you know, anything, what would you say?
Wow, I know that's a tough question, because I would say that it's okay not to know or to admit that you don't know, and that we understand the struggle that, as a teacher, I understand the struggle that they're going through, but I want them to know that they're not alone and they're deeply, deeply appreciated. And like you would do on an airplane, in order to help people, you got to put the oxygen on yourself. You have to take care of yourself so that we can take care of our students and our families.
Doreen Allen is a learning environment specialist with Pittsburgh Public Schools. Thanks for talking to me, Doreen.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With most school districts teaching students remotely, either full or part-time, there's a huge need for childcare for school-aged children, something most of the country wasn't equipped for before the pandemic. 90.5 WESA Sarah Schneider brings us this story from the Millvale Boys and Girls Club, where students now gather every day for their online education.
Wearing masks and headphones, a dozen kindergartners and first graders sit in front of laptops or tablets during their virtual morning classes. A student balances on one leg for PE. Another writes letters on a dry erase board and holds it up to the computer camera. And a kindergartner wearing a big rainbow bow stands up and announces that she just finished a meeting. The 5-year-old was on a Zoom call with her teacher and class. She then calls over Colleen Vilsack, who helps her log onto her art class. Vilsack is an administrator with the Boys and Girls Club. She now spends much of her day doing this, remembering passwords and trying to keep the students focused. Some of the younger kids think she's their teacher.
They're a little confused. The stability is great, and they know where they're at, and they know they've been here before in the past. I think they are having a little bit of difficulty acknowledging that they're in a new step of their lives because there isn't a school for them to go to physically.
The Millvale Boys and Girls Club is one of about 60 remote learning hubs in Allegheny County that are filling the gap for parents who, before the pandemic, didn't need daytime childcare. Most of the Boys and Girls Club locations are at capacity and have a waiting list.
So right now we're all day, and it's a big transition for us because it was typically, you know, before and after school care and doing all the programming for those time slots, and now we're doing all day and our extra stuff on top of it. So it is a busy day. It's, you know, busy kiddos everywhere.
Most sites are covering costs with CARES Act funding covered by the county's Department of Human Services, the early childhood group Trying Together, and the United Way. But Amy Mallon with the county's Office of Community Services says that money will dry up at the end of the year.
Unless there is additional government funding that comes through, we don't have an identified source of funding yet going into 2021.
In Millvale, the kids spend time with their teachers online, then they have an activity, eat lunch, and play in the game room. In a lot of ways, it's similar to what you'd see in a typical school. The hubs are a resource that Mallon says many families need, whether that's because they work outside of the home or just can't facilitate their child's learning during the day.
I mean, we have heard from various providers that, you know, parents have literally cried tears of joy that they had been so stressed out thinking that they were going to have to quit their job because they had small children and didn't know how it was going to work. And so we've heard really universally across the board that parents are so thankful that there is some option for their children.
Providers say one of the most pressing needs is access to reliable Wi-Fi. At the Carnegie Library of Homestead, Executive Director Carol Shreve has noticed students sitting outside with laptops and tablets.
We would see families that they need access to Wi-Fi, and so they were on our steps or they were hanging in the courtyard. We see that all the time. And as soon as I see a laptop or an iPad or some type of PDA or tablet, I know the kids are working on schoolwork.
The library is only open for limited hours now, but the Homestead Library is launching a program that will allow groups of students to come in with an adult to use the space and Wi-Fi and technology. Mallon with the county's Department of Human Services says she expects more of these informal spaces to open in the next few weeks to meet the needs of the community. But for now, it's a waiting game to decide if they should expand existing hubs. Carissa Manillo is the executive director of the early childhood advocacy group Trying Together. She says they're reliant on what the districts decide to do.
What we don't know and what, and I think families then don't know, is this a short-term need that I have, or is this going to be a long-term need based on what happens with the district's decision around whether they'll go back to in-person?
Pittsburgh Public Schools' 23,000 students, for example, are set to return to buildings in early November, but providers say they are preparing for the possibility of a new plan. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We've been asking families for questions. Those very good questions that a kiddo in your life might have but leaves you scratching your head. Well, we're turning to Edwina Kinchington. She's a teacher at the Pittsburgh Science and Technology Academy for some help. So, Edwina, the first question comes from 7-year-old Jackson Payne. Jackson asks, "When I look at the street on a hot day, I see heat waves. What are they, and why can I see them?"
So some days when it is really hot and sunny, you can see this mirage or vision of fake water on the road. Actually, there isn't any water on the road at all. This illusion is caused by refraction or bending of the light from the sun when it passes through the air that lays on top of the road. So a black road, which is able to quickly absorb heat from the light of the sun, raises the temperature of the air right above the road. So that air becomes hotter and is slightly more dense. And then the heated air rises and then it cools a little bit and it's replaced by new air, which then also heats up and rises. And this cycle creates several layers of air of different temperatures just above the road surface. And this causes the light from the sun to be reflected back up when it hits the more dense air that is right above the road rather than hitting the road directly. So what you're seeing on the road is just light being bent in the air, which has been heated by the sun touching the road.
Edwina, we have another question about seeing. This one comes from Amelia. She wants to know, how do eyes work?
Well, in order to see, and how our eyes work is the eye takes in light and transforms that light into an image. So first, light passes through the cornea. That's the clear front layer of the eye. And the cornea is shaped like a dome and it bends the light to help the eye focus. Some of this light enters the eye through then the opening called the pupil. And the iris, the colored part of the eye, controls how much light the pupil lets in. Next, light passes through the lens, and that's the clear inner part of the eye. And the lens works together with the cornea to focus light correctly onto the retina, which is in the very back of the eyeball. And when the light hits the retina, and this is a sensitive layer of tissue that determines this light that we have come into the eye, special cells called photoreceptors turn the light into an electrical signal. Then that electrical signal travels from the retina to a nerve called the optic nerve, which goes to the brain. The brain then turns that signal into the images that we see. So all of those structures working together enable us to see what we see with our eyes.
So it's like the design of a camera on our phones.
Yes, exactly. You let light in, that light gets focused by certain structures, and then that image gets sent to the brain, where the brain processes that image and tells us what we are seeing.
If your child has a question that puzzles you, send it to confluence at WESA.FM. Edwina Kinchington is a teacher at the Pittsburgh Science and Technology Academy. Edwina, thanks for answering these good questions.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.FM/Confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.